Well, welcome everybody to today's episode of the Independent Teacher Podcast. And I am joined by Dr. Katie Riley from the University of Birmingham. So hello, Katie.
Hi, Susan.
And I'm really pleased that you could join us today, because this is such an important topic that we're going to be talking about, obviously the environment, but also about the work that universities do in terms of working with schools and pupils. So can you just start by telling our listeners about your role at Birmingham University and obviously your academic journey to date?
So I am a research fellow. So I finished my PhD in the summer last year. So that was quite a challenging end during the pandemic. So my main role now is working on research projects looking at environmental pollution. So I'm continuing on with some of the microplastics research. But alongside that, I also have public engagement projects. So these are kind of on top of the research, but they really stem from the research that we are currently doing. So we have a project working with local schools on how plastics can impact the environment and things like that. So it's really translating like the current research we do into teaching and educational experiences as well for students of all ages, really.
How important do you think it is that universities do this kind of what we would refer to as outreach work? And then maybe just tell us about some of these projects that you've been doing with primary schools and secondary schools.
I think it's important from the students' perspective and the schools. I think it's really interesting for them to learn firsthand from researchers and academics and things, and to get an understanding of the scientific process. So I think it's a nice experience for them to learn about kind of the wider scientific process and also the actual research we do. But I also think as a researcher, I love it. I think it's really interesting working with students of different ages. It's quite nice from an environmental perspective, based on the work that we do, how engaged they are with the topic, especially with COP26 and everything towards the end of last year, just how engaged and interested they are in how the environment's changing and what they can do as individuals and how they can also influence like their wider circles to make changes. I also think some of the questions they have are so insightful and they're from a completely different perspective. I think that's really interesting, and it can definitely like change like our personal perspectives on the issues and how we communicate the research as well going forwards. Some of the work I do is working with Daphnia, which are commonly referred to as water fleas. So they're a really small freshwater crustacean, super interesting, super useful, a really good indicator species in aquatic environments. And they're kind of the basis of a lot of the public engagement work that we do. And we can take these into schools and we can show pupils and like run through some of the really simple experiments that we can do with them. There's a lot of like visual work because they're transparent organisms, so that's really effective. And some of the questions that they have when they're like working with the Daphnia, like what does that mean for the bigger environment? And then is it right to be testing on animals and things like that? So it spans like the full thing from what are the effects to how we design the experiments. But we are also designing virtual packs as well, so that we don't have to go there in person. And they can use like the online resources of in videos and worksheets and like quizzes and things like that. So we video some of the experiments and then they can access them and go through like the different steps. And that highlights like the scientific process again. So it links really nicely into their curriculum, but it also highlights some of the results. So it can lead to really nice discussions beyond just the topic of science, but in terms of like what we could do better in terms of plastic recycling. And then it can link to them making changes in school.
Is that mainly aimed at secondary school pupils, the online path?
That ties quite nicely into some of their biology modules, I think, and some of the geography ones in terms of the ecosystem management aspects and pollution considerations.
Okay. And how important do you think environmental studies are in the curriculum?
Even when I've been talking to like whole year groups, their interest and also their level of understanding of environmental problems is like, I think it's quite impressive. They're so engaged with the issue. When they were having discussions about COP26, some of the comments they were making were really insightful. And it's not just about the science, it's about how it was being communicated, how it was interacting with like policymakers and government. I think they're going to be driving like key changes forward. I think there's a lot of frustration with how environmental issues have been handled in the past. And I think having the option to study them in a formal academic kind of setting earlier on would give them the opportunity to have that like solid baseline going forwards. And so I personally think it's really important.
Yeah. So you didn't study environmental sciences. So what prompted you to go to university then and take that as a course?
I was really undecided with what I wanted to actually study at university. So marine biology was on the cards at one point. So I was looking around for different courses. I was torn between like geography and like the more classic subjects that you'd have, like the geography, chemistry, marine biology. And then I came across environmental science as a standalone undergraduate course. And it had, I remember very clearly reading it and being like, oh, like that was perfect. It's like somebody took the idea from my head of what I was interested in and just put it into a module form.
I know from previous conversations that we've had that there are concerns about plastics. Maybe just run through some of the concerns that you have about plastics in the environment.
Yes, that is a massive question. I could talk all day about this. I'm going to try and keep it concise. I think there's a lot of concerns about how much plastic there is, where it is, and how long it's going to stay there. And I think we're really starting to understand now how little we understand, if that makes sense. So we have identified what we currently consider hotspots in different environmental regions, areas where plastics are more likely to be deposited, for example, in aquatic environments. And we're, as like a research field, exploring across different kind of medium now. So also considering like air pollution sources of plastic, plastic in soils and plants. So I think we're really understanding how important it is to like research these different points and find these key areas. I think a lot of the considerations are what are going to be the consequences of having the plastics there? How serious could it be? So what are the key organisms that are going to be impacted? And how could that affect the ecosystem as a whole? Is it going to affect any key ecosystem services, for example? So if we look at soil, is it going to affect how the organisms in the soil can then aerate the environment? Is that going to cause issues with waterlogging? All these really big knock-on effects that when you first think, oh, like it's just a bit of plastic, it's like our experience of plastic is obviously as a very inert material. It's useful and we use it on a day-to-day basis and it's not hazardous to us in the context that we use it. So to imagine how it then changes and the hazards that can then pose, I guess, is quite a lot to wrap your head around.
What do you think the biggest hazard is from these plastics that you've talked about?
Well, my personal research is how they can work in combination with other chemicals and stresses in the environment. I think that's an important issue because it provides like this extra surface where things can obviously bind and interact on the surface of the plastic, which is different to another type of chemical. So if it's another type of pollution, for example, that was like dissolved in the water, it wouldn't then have this surface binding to kind of concentrate this. So I'm interested in how it can interact with other like key pollutants and how this could make it maybe worse in different cases or might not have an effect. It's just something that we're really starting to look into. I think there's a lot of concern of how it can move through the food chain. I think this is a really big concern for a lot of people and how it might end. Well, it could be currently in the human food chain, for example. And a lot of this, so for example, if you use fish as the example, a lot of this would then depend on the plastic, whether it's able to translocate within the animal, which basically means it can move from the digestive tract from where the fish has eaten it into the kind of key muscle tissue, which is the part that the humans would then eat. So that's a key factor that's been explored, but there's a lot of variables surrounding this. So I think that's a big concern for a lot of the public. So often when we talk to people, it's like, oh, are we eating plastics currently? And the answer is most likely yes, but we don't know how hazardous this could be or exactly which route this is coming from either.
Right. And when you're talking about it being in soil, So even if you move away from eating fish, you're eating plants that are grown in the soil, and the soil is contaminated.
Yeah, I think the more you think about it, almost the worse it gets, which is quite a depressing thing to point out. But yeah, it's a bit like when you start looking for like plastic pollution in the environment, you just, like, I feel like I see it everywhere now. So even when you go for like a walk somewhere that you think is quite remote, you're like, oh,
yeah,
there's still plastic bottles here.
Have you changed the way you live as a result of the research and the work that you now do, or do you keep it within a context where you think, I'm okay at the moment, I'm not going to change the way I live?
I think I have made some lifestyle changes across the board, and that stems back to when I started studying environmental science as an undergraduate. There's a lot of things I changed at that point.
And like, you're happy to share those with us?
Oh yeah, one of the big ones was going vegetarian. That was like a big change. I'm still the only vegetarian in my family. I guess it's, I have a really good understanding of some of the challenges, and the same with plastic pollution. Like, I do want to make changes, and do, I know there's still a lot of things that I could definitely do better, but I also think it's quite important to still be approachable to other people. For example, like, I'm always happy to have discussions with people about plastic and what I could personally do better. And I don't want to make people feel like they're being judged, for example, or like they couldn't ask me, like, oh, what do you think about this? So I do try and make like smart swaps and use a lot less like single-use plastics and things like that, for example. Like, those really easy, well, easy for me, I guess, changes to make. So a reusable coffee cup, for example, was such an easy switch. And like all of those small changes, but at the same time trying to not feel like I'm lecturing people constantly for things, because
that's from the context of waste rather than pollutant chemicals entering the food chain.
Yeah, I think part of it is making those small changes that you can. So like, we do what's convenient for us anyway, so it's just taking that extra little step, for example. So maybe it's not always convenient to carry a disposable coffee cup, but if you get in the habit of it, it then becomes convenient. So it's making those like small steps.
Interesting topic. We could talk about it for a long time, but we do need to move on. How does the research that you're doing at Birmingham University, how does it inform government policies?
Again, something that I could talk about forever. So for example, if we use the Daphne case study, so it sounds quite simple on the face of things, like how does plastic impact this one test organism? But then when we start changing other aspects of it, for example, if we use more complex water, for example, to run the experiments in, and we add like other more environmentally realistic elements to it, so make it more like the water that we'd find in rivers, and less like the water the Daphne are used to growing in, how does that change the endpoint? And we've seen some really interesting results just from those studies. So when we add in the chemicals and other pollutants on top of that, it gets again more complex. So we can use this to kind of say, like, the baseline tests that we use, so these really standard test designs that we use across the board for plastics and nanomaterials and chemicals, we should be making them more realistic so that we have a better understanding of what's actually happening in the environment, so that we can set better like targets and thresholds. So if we test it in scenario A, which is really simplistic, really nice clean water, loads of food for the Daphne and just the particles, and we find really low toxicity, we might think, oh, actually it's not hazardous. Whereas if we compare it to scenario B, and it's more environmentally realistic, the water's a lot more complex and there might be additional chemicals or less food, and there's a lot higher toxicity, like, that's more realistic. So we should be setting like lower thresholds and like taking more of a precautionary principle, like against the problem.
And do you think the work you're doing then is actually having an effect on government policy and therefore on the planet as a whole?
We're in the process of publishing different parts, the various studies across my whole PhD at the moment. So I think that'll be really, really useful.
Do you think you are being listened to?
I think it's a slow process. So the specific tests that we were looking at for the Daphnia, for example. That is a slow process to get those parts changed, but talking to other scientists and things and getting things changed on that level is also helpful. So if we start gathering more evidence and more people do like varying different studies, we can kind of piece together the picture. And I think there's been evidence in the past of the government, for example, taking into consideration research and like the results from this. And there's so not just necessarily the science either, but also the way that people have engaged with the topic. So with the microbead ban and things like that, responding to kind of consumer pressure and like the public interest in that, that was really effective. There's also a lot of great research in that area too, to kind of like this almost two-pronged approach. So you've got the science and you've also got the public interest. So yeah, I think so. Maybe I'm just being hopeful, but yeah.
I think the beads were a bit easier for people to visualize, aren't they? Than yes. A microorganism.
Yeah. And it's also I think the beads as well, because it's one thing you can kind of feel like a success. Like it feels successful when you like it's basically been tackled. Whereas if it's things like fibers from clothes, for example, like I think that's a really complex topic to kind of solve. So obviously we don't want people to stop washing their clothes, but then the fibers are being released. So where can we address this problem? I think maybe that's a little bit more complex.
So COP26, it's been quite a while ago now. Have you had time to reflect on it, and did it achieve anything of significance?
I'm going to be optimistic and say hopefully things will change. So off kind of the back of COP26, the Environment Act has also been passed now. So I'm quietly optimistic that that is going to be effective in some of the initiatives that is. So for example, they're aiming to tackle some of the single-use plastic. So I think it's a step in the right direction.
What about gas and creating carbon neutral fuel and things like that? Where do you think we're heading?
I think that's super complex, but I think we need to target some of the greenwashing where there's buzzwords on a lot of the environmental issues that make it seem like it's environmentally like friendly or not hazardous, when that might not necessarily be the case. I think that's the same for plastics and things like that. So when we have discussions about bioplastics, it's like, well, what does that actually mean? So I think to have like effective change, we need to make sure that terminology is sound at the same time. So there's a lot of things where it's like, oh, it's environmentally friendly, or oh, it's like carbon neutral. It's like, well, what do you mean though? How? I think when you dig into it, sometimes there like isn't an answer. That would be one thing that I would really like to tackle, kind of stricter regulations and requirements on is like this actual terminology.
Right. Okay. Now, we're almost at the end. Where do you see yourself in the next 5 to 10 years, ideally?
I love what I'm doing now. So I would love to still be doing this in 5 to 10 years' time. I'd love to build on some of the research from my PhD work, and I'm working on a really interesting project currently, so it'd be really nice to see the results from that. And I'd love to still be doing the public engagement things as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Still working in research, informing the government, writing papers on plastics, and hopefully having some clearer answers. Can I say thank you ever so much, Katie, for joining me today on the Independent Teacher Podcast? It's been fascinating. I'm not sure I will change my habits. It's called lack of willpower, I think, in terms of eating certain foods. But, you know, I'll continue to recycle. I think that's really important. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. You have been listening to the Independent Teacher Podcast with me, your host, Susan Pallister, my guest on today's show, Dr. Katie Riley.